Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you, President Lowell Smith. I'm happy to be among my fellow truth seekers. All of us are very much animated by the successes we have had in our common ventures. It isn't often, is it, that we get such a gratifying testimony as we recently had. I think of Robert Heilbronner writing in Dissent. He said, as I'm sure all of you noticed in your regular reading of Dissent, and those of you who didn't see it there may have picked it up when republished in the Wall Street Journal, he wrote, "Capitalism has been as unmistakable a success as socialism has been a failure." Here is the part that's hard to swallow. "It has been the Friedmans, Hayek's, von Mises's who have maintained that capitalism would flourish and that socialism would develop incurable ailments. All three have regarded capitalism as the natural system of free men. All have maintained that left to its own devices, capitalism would achieve material growth more successfully than any other system. From this admittedly impressionistic and incomplete sampling, I draw the following discomforting generalization. The further to the right one looks, the more prescient has been the historical foresight. The further to the left, the less so." It is good to know that we in the Philadelphia Society have been here all these years, this little priesthood, irradiating the little illumination that is the amber of the Philadelphia Society. Tom Wolfe said at the 35th anniversary of National Review that he saw nothing wrong in gloating from time to time. I'm not sure I'd use the same word, but what is exactly the right word to describe the pleasures one takes in empirical verification of postulates we have held, leading to conclusions we have insisted lie at the other end of theoretical exercises leading from those postulates? We're entitled to celebrate. A celebration is prescribed, indeed even scheduled, in the Lenten season. In our world, it is always a Lenten season, in that there is nothing even the Philadelphia Society can do to root out either invincible ignorance or the wreckage that ensues from the writhings and thrashings of the iconoclastic imperative. But every now and again, we have our Laetare Sundays in which we rejoice, and there is much to rejoice over, even as we know that when the clock strikes 12, we'll need to redouble our efforts merely to maintain the ground we have achieved, because doubters tend to breed faster than believers, it being a human temptation to take shortcuts in attempting to realize utopia. And shortcuts are almost always attempted through the instrumentality of the state, which at once can organize armies of soldiers to fight for liberty and armies of soldiers and policemen and bureaucrats to attenuate liberty and to enslave. Having arrived quite by accident into the use of martial language, I remind myself that when our Commodore, Don Lipset, asked me in February to give a title for my, quote, speech, unquote, as he insisted on calling it, I paused to remark that it is a relief to hear something I say referred to as a speech. It is almost universally now referred to as a presentation. As in, we all thank Mr. Buckley for his fine presentation. I'm always tempted when that happens to me, which is almost always, to rise and say that I give presentations only when I am attempting to persuade a corporation to advertise in National Review. You will note from the scarcity of such ads that self-evidently Mr. Buckley does not make fine presentations. In any event, as many of you have known, Don Lipset, through prestidigitative techniques not equally mastered by any other human being on earth with the exception of Mother Teresa, manages to deploy muscles of steel which are guaranteed to prevail over your own inclinations, in this case as in every other, in my case, to defer until the last minute the selection of the title and text of any presentation. So insistent was he that I finally blurted out over electronic MCI from Switzerland last February, call it Reflections on War and Peace. Indeed, that is how he has advertised my remarks at this, my favorite forum, and lo, what is on my mind is questions of war and peace. I will proceed, as I am given to doing, by affirming a few propositions, with some of which I hope many of you will agree. If not, I have known rejection before. Once upon a time, I was even rejected by Robert Heilbronner. My first proposition is that our victory in the Cold War gives us ground for great satisfaction, but satisfaction diluted by historical humility. All the joy that effloresced during the months after the Berlin Wall came down was heartfelt. We are, after all, talking about 110 million people who lived behind the Iron Curtain, not counting the Soviet Union's 250 million. But what these people can't reasonably be expected to have is a large appetite for the great gurgles of self-satisfaction coming up from Western opinion brewers, who, filing their fingernails, advised us, to paraphrase Anthony Lewis of the New York Times, that we told you it would all be okay if we just waited it out. The human tendency is to forget quickly and conveniently past suffering, especially if it was other people's suffering, most especially if you were conceivably responsible for it, as we were in major ways responsible for suffering behind the Iron Curtain beginning in Yalta and up through the failure over the decades of successive administrations to pursue liberationist strategical analysis. And looking over the dead wall, if there is contrition going on among the hundreds of thousands of Soviet agents, including Mr. Gorbachev, who imprisoned, tortured, and killed during the past 40 years, their grief is stoically self-contained. The Jewish community will never let the world forget about the Holocaust, and understandably so. Every living German is aware of that Holocaust, most of them unborn when it happened. By contrast, not one in 500 Westerners could answer the question, how many Ukrainians were starved to death by Stalin in 1932-33? And not one in 1,000 would know that that figure is higher than that for all those killed during the Holocaust. One wonders how many Oliver Stones, so mindful of the suffering associated with Vietnam, will, during the next 10 years, devote their splendid, indignant energies to dramatizing the fate of Eastern Europe during the 44 years just past. We can sleep better for knowing that our cousins have regained their freedom, but we can't bring back to life those who lost their lives, nor bring back lifetimes in freedom to those who spent theirs without civil liberty. Like the Jews who survived the Holocaust, we are left only with a moral mandate. It must not happen again to the extent that we can prevent it, which raises instantly such vexing questions as, might we have prevented the slaughter among the Kurds? And derivatively, because the answer is, of course, yes, we could have prevented it, would it have been prudent to do so, strategically sophisticated, historically mature, politically advisable? Before opining on this question, I'm drawn to probe the future of those so recently emancipated, and accordingly proffer my next proposition, which is that it is unlikely that Adam Smith can save the East European states, let alone the Soviet Union. In National Review a year ago, Milton Friedman told us that in his habitually unassailable judgment, the newly liberated East European states need to take drastically anti-statist steps in order to make substantial economic progress. What he says, of course, applies a fortiori to the Soviet Union. Mr. Friedman believes that any state that has suffered from so protracted an experience with socialism cannot handle the problem of economic resuscitation while simultaneously taking on the welfare load routinely accepted by affluent Western democracies. If Mr. Friedman is correct, the alternatives faced by Poland, Bulgaria, Romania, Czechoslovakia are of international consequence. We may find ourselves dealing with people who have a vision of liberty and prosperity, who, then denied prosperity, are attracted to false utopianism. Hermann Göring testified at Nuremberg that it was as simple as this, that in 1933, Germany had no alternative than to move in the direction it did. Within the Soviet Union, the situation is somewhere between desperate and chaotic. In Germany, it is the socialists who in the past few weeks have profited from the hard realism Mr. Friedman speaks of as necessary. It's worth it to travel in the Soviet Union, as many of you have, of course, done, sometimes, to be sure, voyeuristically. Personal experiences stay usefully in the memory. There are, of course, significant changes brought on by Glasnost. Yet although the marketplace has been officially acclaimed as to be preferred to a command economy, it isn't only in the public sector that it fails to work. It is even in the little recesses of the private sector. The cultural ignorance of the free market and of cost efficiency is very quickly apparent, for instance, to guests of the Intourist Hotel in Moscow. The economic idea of arbitrage, the process that prompts people to buy a product where it is cheap and sell it where it is dear until prices level out, has not even worked its wonders within the Intourist Hotel in Moscow, let alone in Greater Moscow, let alone in Great Russia. On the second floor of the Intourist Hotel, you can buy 5 ounces of caviar for $29. On the first floor, the same can costs $44. Outside, the five of you who are traveling together ask for a taxi to go to a museum. You're told that 5 passengers are too many for 1 taxi, that you will need 2 taxis, and to take you to where you are going will be $5 per cab. You hesitate ever so briefly to digest alternatives, and the Russian driver becomes an entrepreneur in the Russian style. Well, he tells you grandly, you're not to worry. He will make an exception and take all 5 of you in his 1 cab for $10. You need to telephone a companion staying in another room. You call the operator. It rings busy. It rings busy for an hour. It's very important, so you descend to the hotel reception desk and ask the woman at the desk, where is Mr. Peter Samara staying? What then happens is on the order of asking your grandmother to come up with a picture of her high school graduation. The receptionist holds up a lap full of yellow slips and begins to go over them one by one. At the end, she says, he is not here. Yes, he is here, you insist. He's been here for 2 days. He is not here, she repeats. At that moment, Peter shows up. You exchange intelligence and ask for his room number, which is 601. So that from now on, you can dial him directly. The next morning, you wish to call 601. You follow the hotel dialing instructions. To call 601, you must dial 203-2097. Well, you can handle that. Does that mean that to call 602, you would dial 203-2098? No. 203-5040. At 3:30 p.m., on your way out, you report to the concierge that your toilet is stopped up. You come in at 11 p.m. and note that it is still stopped up. At 9 a.m., it is still stopped up. It occurs to anyone scheduled to check out of the hotel that morning that there is an obvious way to leave the mark of his displeasure. The airport in Moscow is an extension of hotel life. You arrive 3 hours before flight time, as you are told to do. You need to complete a form which reminds you of Professor Parkinson's book, One Upmanship, because you are not given, where crucial, room enough to supply the information Moscow desires in its glasnosti and fury to get from you. If you're carrying $87, you're required to write out not merely 87, but $87 in approximately a third of an inch of space on a form which no Russian in his right mind, which includes some Russians, is ever going to read. But somehow it is not as it was in previous visits. There is the occasional smile, not universal. Granted, Gorbachev hasn't in a couple of years made Moscow into Tahiti. His popularity, according to a recent poll, is about the equal of Lyndon LaRouche in the United States. What exactly is the voice of the Russian people is not easy to determine. It would be presumptuous to infer from the popularity of Mr. Yeltsin that their voice is the same as the voice of those who 200 years ago were instructed by the insights of Adam Smith. My ensuing proposition is that the decline of the Soviet Union cannot be arrested by United States foreign policy. Late in December, the Soviet government instituted rationing in the city of Leningrad for the first time since the Nazi invasion in 1942. That is a measure of current Soviet hardship. 9 months ago, I was told in Moscow that the Russian harvest was overflowing, but that less than one half of it would be recovered owing to the collapse of all rail and road transportation. It's been nearly 2 years since then Prime Minister Ryzhkov, facing an audience of 700 economists, announced that in his judgment, the Soviet Union had 18 months left to live, quote, unless drastic alternative courses are taken. We know that drastic alternative courses have not been taken, and that we are indeed seeing the dissolution of the Soviet Union. Over the course of a year up until the summer, I advocated extravagant purchases by the United States of Soviet military equipment, aggressive in character and redundant in quantity. What the Soviet Union needed, I reasoned, was $100 billion a year for 3 years until they could turn their country around. And what we needed to secure the peace was the end of the destructive potential of the Soviet aggressive state. My reading of events persuades me that the Soviet Union cannot really use the money. Its problems are organic. I'm reminded of the short story by Oscar Wilde. The young man with the disfigured face pays a large sum of money to a sculptor to make him a mask to hide his ugliness. This is done, and the man with the mask grows into old age, although all the world knows only the fine young face of the master sculptor. And the man with the mask devotes his life to ennobling work, spending his time and resources to relieve the misery of others. In old age, he falls sick, and his doctor diagnoses the need to remove the mask, does so, and to the astonishment of the actress company, discovers young and beautiful features. The old unsightly face has been transfigured by the nobility of the life he led, and now the mask has become reality. The Soviet economy can't work its way out of the cesspool it has lived in unless it shrives its past, and this can't be done by a transfusion of foreign money. There is certainly an urgent case to be made for stimulating our SDI program, indeed, for persuading the Soviet Union that in respect of protection from incoming missiles, we have interests in common. But short of pressing those, we have primarily only to stand and wait. I move to the related question touching on the ultimate alternative in foreign policy, debated so extensively last January. My next proposition is that no useful exchange on war and peace can be had when one party to it insists on the inviolability of human life. Our tradition teaches us that human life is sacrosanct, but not that it is inviolable. The United States, all conservatives and most libertarians agree, has the authority to risk the life of an American soldier. It isn't possible to argue with someone whose meanings are inchoately pacifist. There is no negotiable analytical tender those who abjure pacifist doctrine but continue to press the primacy of human life need to be convinced that a sacrifice undertaken today will convincingly diminish the magnitude of a sacrifice probable tomorrow. The anti-war people never really found a persuasive doctrine after using up the argument that in the Persian Gulf we should continue with the sanctions until they ran dry, perhaps in recognition of how straitened their arguments were, we began to hear in mid-February the reductionist argument about a single human life. Anna Quinlan of the New York Times, scoffing at those who took comfort in the low casualty figures during the first 4 weeks of our engagement, said, "Sure, it doesn't matter that only 6 American aviators have been killed, unless one of them is Joe, and he happens to be your father, your brother, your husband, or your lover." And from Arthur Schlesinger Jr., the comment made in January, "The Gulf War is, quote, not worth one human life." The attempt to write policy over the corpse of the kid over there who just got married, the youngest son of proud and devoted parents, is a sentimentalization of calculations necessarily made, so to speak, in cold blood. Liberty, Jefferson once said, needs to be watered regularly by the blood of tyrants and patriots. That formulation scares some of us off, sounding as it does like the charge of the Light Brigade with march music by John Philip Sousa. But you can dry out that observation and ask, is it or is it not historically the case that free societies have had to defend their freedom at the cost of human life? And sort of a happy ending to human history are likely to continue to have to do so. If the answer is yes, this does need to be done, then you can accost the second question. Does the threat to your freedom begin on the day that the Nazi trooper deposits you in a train to Buchenwald? Or does it begin a little before that time, say when Hitler took over the Rhineland and it was still just possible to stop him? Because, of course, it wasn't just Joey who died finally stopping Hitler. It was 50 million Joeys. A mature society, alert to timely action against destroyers of the peace, makes its bid. We lost 500,000 men between Pearl Harbor and the flight from Saigon. It was calculations of that order that armed us psychologically for the casualty figures we feared lay ahead for us last January, a thundercloud of fear that all but passed over us. We were ready, and that didn't mean that the death of Joey wasn't heartbreaking to those who loved him, but our responsibility then, and our responsibility as we face international perspectives in the future, is always to satisfy ourselves on the basic question. Accordingly, my next proposition is that in the Persian Gulf, our vital interests were at stake. America beat us, but also some of our best friends have done their best to sully our policy by saying that it all had to do with oil, the mere mention of which justifies the disdain of far-seeing men of large heart. The mere mention of oil in this context is shorthand for rank materialism. It is worthwhile exploring quite directly the fastidious distinctions here implied. The distinction between oil and, oh, poetry, or whatever it is that it's okay to use force to secure. Affirmative action, maybe. Oil may be thought of as that murky stuff that produces rich and vulgar Texans. The trouble is that to think about it in that way is the equivalent of thinking about an unemployed man seeking a job as a materialist. Until another form of efficient energy is developed, the industrial world needs oil, even as the unemployed man needs a job. Those who are indifferent to the universal availability of oil might as well be indifferent to the universal unavailability of employment. Saudi Arabia has 1/4 of the world's reserves of oil, which combined with Kuwait and Iraq add up to more than 40%. If we grant that the United States has a vital interest in world peace, then we grant that it had a vital interest in seeing to it that the Persian Gulf should not become either an instrument of extortion or a pit of anarchy around which armed vultures of the world would likely gather to make other than love. Indeed, a strong case might have been made for threatening military force against the cartel, that until it self-destructed by reason of avarice among constituent parts, waged economic war against the West for a decade, beginning in 1973. The isolationist tradition against entangling alliances was not bad geopolitical thought in other days, other times. The notion that we depended on any particular commodity that could be produced only in the Mideast or in China or in Australia was quaint. The United States was never a fully realized autarkic dream, a nation that produced for itself everything that it consumed. From our earliest days, we were a nation of traders. And throughout the 19th century, we were busy exporting our goods and importing others. But it wasn't really until World War II that we faced the scarcity of a critical commodity so agonizingly that only doctors and generals were permitted to buy a new rubber tire. What then happened so suddenly by American historical standards was the prospect not only of running out of something that we didn't ourselves have enough of, oil or molybdenum or whatever, but also at about the same time, we came within the range of weapons we could not cope with, because nobody can cope with nuclear weapons after they have landed. We can only either A, get in the way of their being manufactured, as Israel did by bombing Iraq's gestating nuclear plant in 1981, or else B, deter a nation from dispatching its bombs by threatening insupportable retaliation, or C, stop the bomb midway by SDI. The stated objective of Iraq in the current exercises was to annex Kuwait in order to force it to limit production, in order to increase the price of oil. And OPEC tends to work or not to work according as Saudi Arabia cooperates or does not cooperate. It is only Saudi Arabia that produces or can do so so much oil that it uniquely has the power to affect the world price. That is why we went to war, and the moment is past due when the Bush administration approaches King Fahd of Saudi Arabia with such words as these: "Now, look, Your Majesty, we bailed you out of a no-win situation. Except for the United States Marines, you and your court would be sitting in Monaco right now. Now, we don't want to take over your country, but we don't want either to become your economic subjects. And that means that we have to look upon your oil as the whole world is slowly coming to look upon pollution. That the source of the pollution is in Detroit or in Chernobyl isn't the point. It is the point that the impact of what happens in Detroit or Chernobyl can affect Manitoba and Norway. So as a sign of permanent solidarity between the great people of Saudi Arabia and the great people of the United States of America, and the great people of the NATO powers, and of the defunct Warsaw powers, we will now execute this here agreement, binding the price of Saudi Arabian oil for 50 years to the price of free market oil at Galveston, Texas. If sometime in the very near future such an agreement is announced, we will have amply documented our motives for going into the Persian Gulf in August of 1990, Our perspectives will establish that we have protected our vital interests and those of the industrial world through the lifetime of my grandchild and King Fahd's 10,000 grandchildren. My final proposition on the war and peace question is that circumstances argued the wisdom of pressing forward during that first week in March to unseat Saddam Hussein. Conservatives properly distinguish between principles and ideology. Principles become ideologized when they are applied without reference to circumstances. What were the relevant principles? President Bush, defending his inactivity in mid-April, put it this way: "The United States is not going to intervene militarily in Iraq's internal affairs and risk being drawn into a Vietnam-style quagmire." There are problems in defending this proposition. One, it requires a great imagination just to begin with to suppose that the United States had not been intervening militarily in Iraq's internal affairs. We mobilized and instituted a worldwide quarantine of Iraq just to begin with, if not directly military, It was certainly paramilitary, and indeed in some respects more directly an intervention in Iraq's internal affairs than the subsequent smart bombing of its military installations. When the local stationer can't import pencils, we do right to think of this as an intervention in internal affairs. Two, we correctly and charitably dismiss the analogy to Vietnam and spare Mr. Bush the embarrassment of submitting it to licentious dissection. Suffice simply to say that our ventures in Vietnam and Iraq had only in common the existence of an American military in the field. Three, Mr. Bush might have ordered the army to go forward to Baghdad, stopping short of the capital only if Saddam Hussein fled before the American troops arrived. In giving that order, President Bush was leaning on the American tradition of keeping one's hand away from other people's internal problems in failing to give that order. Now, this tradition, however short-lived, is entirely honorable. I have myself been guided ever since I first came upon it by the maxim of Senator Fulbright framed 25 years ago, quote, insofar as a nation is content to practice its doctrines within its own frontiers, that nation, however repugnant its ideology, is one with which we have no proper quarrel. It was under the patronage of this distinction, for instance, that we felt it appropriate in 1965 to land the Marines in the eastern half of Hispaniola to interdict what looked to us like a threatened extension of the Soviet Empire, while entirely ignoring the western half of that island, where Papa Doc Duvalier was committing atrocities against human beings as voraciously as his communist counterparts. We've come a long way since Woodrow Wilson charged us with making the world safe for democracy, and John F. Kennedy hailed the American opportunity to bring freedom to the remotest corner of the world. President Bush and his spokesman, including General Schwarzkopf, the post David Frost Schwarzkopf, also stressed the explicitness of the United Nations mandate, which was indeed concerned primarily with the liberation of Kuwait. In doing so, the administration was treating the United Nations mandate with such frugal specificity as to satisfy Neanderthal strict constructionism. Floating about in Resolution 678 is a sentence enjoining the coalition forces to, quote, use all necessary means to uphold and implement Security Council Resolution 660, etc., and all subsequent relevant resolutions, and to restore international peace and security in the area. It is inconceivable that anyone this side of the Ramsey-Clark wing of public opinion would have held that our forces were legally immobilized on midnight February the 28th simply because effective resistance had been overcome. A military column sufficient in strength to have ousted Saddam Hussein could have reached Baghdad within 36 hours, military judgment seems to concur. What is absolutely plain, given the events of the ensuing 7 weeks, is that we did not restore international peace and security in the area. It can hardly be maintained that we did so when during that period over 1 million Kurds were ravaged and effectively exiled, even if the Entente called Diel concluded the day before yesterday endures longer than preceding pacts between the Iraqi government and the Kurds. These slaughters in the south and in the north will not be undone. It is not at this point hyperbolic to say that international peace and security are inconsistent with the continuation of Saddam Hussein in power. For, from all of which, we correctly deduce the following, which is that the United States should have consummated its operation in liberating Kuwait by dispossessing the government that enslaved Kuwait. Call it, if one seeks a formal dispensation, a prudential or controlled improvisation. It is, in my judgment, profoundly conservative to argue at first from definition and to argue after a certain point from circumstance. The first step requires that we absolutely affirm the principle, in this case, no use of force, except when vital interests are at stake. The second step permits us to seize the moment, catching the tide of favorable geopolitical momentums in order to advance policies that inure not only to our own interests, but to humane interests in general. In seizing the opportunity and saving the Kurds, we'd have exhibited that same respect for the decent opinions of mankind, on whose relevance we insisted when we first put together our national enterprise in the Declaration of Independence. The justification here given for going ahead with controlled improvisation is intended to explore the theoretical structure of U.S. government military policy, but we should add that there is geopolitical justification. A prudential or controlled improvisation. It is, in my judgment, profoundly conservative to argue at first from definition and to argue after a certain point from circumstance. The first step requires that we absolutely affirm the principle, in this case, no use of force, except when vital interests are at stake. The second step permits us to seize the moment, catching the tide of favorable geopolitical momentums in order to advance policies that inure not only to our own interests, but to humane interests in general. In seizing the opportunity and saving the Kurds, we'd have exhibited that same respect for the decent opinions of mankind, on whose relevance we insisted when we first put together our national enterprise in the Declaration of Independence. The justification here given for going ahead with controlled improvisation is intended to explore the theoretical structure of U.S. government military policy. But we should add that there is geopolitical justification. The image of America can translate into the influence of America. The image of America plummeted during the past month as we were seen standing platonically by in Sunday-suited primness, when we uniquely had the reserves easily to stop Saddam Hussein. Had we followed through, it is likely that we'd be facing a lesser degree of intractability in our current search for arrangements that would provide at once for Israeli security and a Palestine nation. And so I close by saluting you all. It was almost 30 years ago that Ed Fuller and I each put up $50 to incorporate the Philadelphia Society. I swear I never knew a bigger bang for a buck. Don Lipset has been our big bertha. We owe him the kind of debt only sincerely convinced free men can give, the debt of gratitude. He has been the organization's catalyst. I'm sure you share with me the senses I have suggested of being his creatures. But I would guess that we are docile servants, sharply contrasting with that dumb servitude our enemy, the state, organically desires to impose on us. I wish you a spirited weekend, which I wish I could share with you. But that would mean sharing with you my wife. And this the Supreme Court has not yet demanded. Good night.